Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show, and I'm your host, Virginia Ashberry. Tonight, Life Rattle number 1298 features two classic stories by Beth Jones. The first is about her fight for the environment, and the second takes us to a conflict in the Mexican jungle. Beth Jones is a writer and activist, born and raised in Ottawa. After high school, Jones left Ottawa for Hamilton, where she studied psychology at McMaster University. After Hamilton, she attended graduate school in Baltimore, where she lasted 8 months. She fled, as she put it, in 1990 after getting her master's degree and moved to Toronto. In Toronto, Jones worked for Greenpeace for 5 years. After Greenpeace, Beth Jones returned to school at OISE, where she received her master's degree in education. Jones continued her environmental activism as an innovator, co-founding the organization named Moving the Economy, with interest particularly in the realm of sustainable transportation. Beth Jones's first story tonight takes us to a local environmental protest, and the second story is a wild, adventurous tale which travels from Toronto to the jungles of southern Mexico and back again. My favorite aspect of these stories is that Beth Jones takes her activism very seriously but parks her own ego at the door. So let's listen now as Beth Jones reads her first story titled Under the Van. And you're listening to Life Rattle from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And please remember, some Life Rattle stories contain situations and language that some listeners may find offensive.
Under the Van by Beth Jones. The call came into the motel room at 10:30 a.m. We'd been holed up in there for 2 days waiting, but by 10:45 we were driving into the Sarnia rail yard. The van bumped as Dean drove over the tracks and then came to a stop. Everyone scrambled out. I ran to the front of the van and shimmied under. Sherry passed me the pipe, and I placed it over the axle. The pipe was about 5 inches wide, 4 feet long, and slightly curved. Just the right shape for an arm to fit inside. I reached into it, feeling for the post welded halfway up. I was in past my elbow before I felt it. I clipped onto the post with the chain that was padlocked around my wrist. Sherry shimmied in beside me, slid her arm into the other end of the pipe, and clipped on. Meanwhile, Frank and Marcia erected a sign beside the van and chained themselves to it. Chlorine kills, was what the sign said. It was 10:46. Everything was going according to plan. Dean radioed the boat. We're in position, he said. You're going to have to move that van, boy. It's on the tracks, some guys yelled. From under the van, I saw Dean's legs walk towards the voices. Hi there. We're with Greenpeace. I'm sorry, we can't move that van because there are two women chained underneath it. They're blocking the chlorine shipment that's coming out of the Dow plant this morning. A couple of guys peered under the van. Hi, I said, as brightly as I could. They looked at the pipe with our arms in it hanging over the axle. They cursed and walked away. The first thing they'll do is call the cops, Dean had told us. That's good. The police will stay calm. They'll take Frank and Marcia away, but they'll let me stay. They like to keep someone around who isn't chained down. Sure enough, a few minutes later, the cops arrived with bolt cutters. They cut Frank and Marcia off the sign and took them away. They looked under the van at us. Bolt cutters wouldn't work. That's why our arms were in the pipe. The cops walked away. I craned my neck, wondering if I could see the dock where the shipment was headed. The boat was supposed to be there, blocking the mooring where the barge was supposed to pick up the shipment. All I could see was rail cars and legs. Dean's legs were standing next to the cops. "The next thing they'll do is call the fire department," Dean had told us. "That's good. The fire department is trained for this. They'll probably cut a hole in the floor of the van with a blowtorch and then cut through the pipe to get you out." I looked up at the floor of the van. I imagined a blowtorch cutting through it and wondered how the firemen would keep me from getting burned. Maybe they used asbestos blankets. Dean's legs walked back towards the van. Then his face appeared. "They're taking me away now. I know I said that doesn't usually happen, but don't worry, you'll be fine. Use this radio to talk to the boat if you need to." It was 11:15. Things were no longer going according to plan. One of the cops crawled under the van beside Sherry. "How long do you plan to stay here?" he asked. "Long enough to make our point," Sherry answered. He looked at her arm and peered up the pipe. "So that chain is padlocked around your wrist and then attached to a post in the middle of that pipe?" he asked. "Yes," Sherry answered. "Do you have the key to that padlock?" he asked. "No," Sherry answered. He went on like that for a long time, asking questions about who we were, why we were doing this, what was so bad about chlorine, whether or not we'd done stuff like this before, and if we'd ever been arrested. He was a nice guy, but I didn't trust him. I wanted him to leave. Then, as soon as he did leave, I missed him. He was the only guy around who wasn't cursing us. After the cop left, I started thinking about the firemen again. I wondered why they were taking so long. I thought about the blowtorch cutting through the pipe, and I wondered how hot the pipe would get when they did that. Then, one of the railway guys came by. He told us they were going to lift the van and move it off the tracks. He said they were going to lift it, with or without us, underneath it. He said they were just waiting for a winch to arrive. And then he walked away. "I guess there aren't going to be any firemen," I said to Sherry. Sherry radioed the boat. Her voice quivered as she told them about the plan to lift the van with us underneath it. "Do you think that's safe?" she asked. "We could unclip any time we wanted. The clip that attached the chain to the post in the pipe was just a dog leash clip. But they had told us we should only do that if we felt really unsafe. We'd been counting on Dean's advice to make that judgment. Now Dean was gone, and Sherry was hoping that the guys on the boat would be able to help. "It's your decision," was all they said. "Ask them if the boat is blocking the dock," I said. If it was, then I figured it didn't really matter if we unclipped or not. The shipment would still be blocked. But before Sherry could ask somebody, there was a yell. "Hey, they have a radio!" The cop crawled back under the van and reached for the radio. Sherry tried to keep it out of his grasp, but there wasn't much she could do about it since she was lying flat on her back with one arm up a pipe. The cop took the radio and crawled back out. Now we had no Dean, no fireman, and no radio. I silently cursed the people on the boat. "They're all having fun together," I thought. "And I'm stuck here under this van while people basically threaten to kill me. I'm never going to put myself in this situation again. Next time, I'm going to be the organizer. Next time, I'm going to be the person getting the other people to do the dirty work. After his lunch break, the cop came back. We found these keys in your friend's shoes. They didn't fit the locks that they used to chain to the sign, so we figured they must fit yours. I worked a deal with the railway guys. They're going to hold off on lifting the van while I see if I can unlock you. He took one of the keys and tried to reach up the pipe with it, but his arm wouldn't fit in the pipe beside Sherry's. He got a stick from one of the other cops and taped the key to it. Then he could reach inside the pipe to the padlock, but he couldn't see anything. He got a flashlight and held it in his mouth, pointing it up the pipe. Then he could get the key up to the padlock, but the padlock moved around, so he couldn't get the key to go in the hole. After an hour or so of this, he realized it wasn't going to work. One of the railway guys came by and said they weren't going to wait any longer. He crawled out from under the van. They backed a truck up near the van. I imagined the van being lifted. I imagined us hanging off the axle with our arms in the pipe. I imagined the van being lowered again. I thought about how I might position myself so I wouldn't get crushed. I thought about my head, which was wedged beside the front tire. I imagined my head getting crushed under that tire. I imagined dying. I thought about the headlines that would make and wondered if it would help the campaign. Then I heard a helicopter, and I started to cry. I knew it must be a TV station, and the railway guys wouldn't dare lift the van while the press was watching. I also knew the helicopter wouldn't be able to see us under the van. I stretched my free arm out as far as I could around the tire, but I could only reach a few inches beyond it. I waved desperately while the sound of the helicopter faded away. They put chains around the front bumper. It hadn't occurred to me that they would lift the van just by the bumper. I looked around to see how it was attached. Two rusty bolts. I imagined the van being lifted and the bolts giving way. I thought about how the van would bounce. There were a few inches of clearance above my head, so if it only bounced a little, my head might be okay. I looked around to see how the rest of my body might fare. And for the first time I noticed that Sherry's pelvis was right under the drive shaft. There was no clearance. If the van bounced, it would crush her pelvis. They tightened the chains. Then the cop looked under the van at us. "Look, I admire you for what you're doing, but these guys are really serious. I think you should get out if you can." Until that moment, I had really believed they were bluffing, that they wouldn't really lift the van. Surely they must understand that it might kill us. Then I looked up at the cop, and I saw tears welling in his eyes. Sherry and I looked at each other and nodded. We unclipped and pulled our arms out of the pipe. Unknown hands grabbed at me and pulled me out roughly. Standing up, I felt naked without the van on top of me. The sudden light was harsh on my eyes, which had grown accustomed to the van's shadow. I blinked and wobbled as they led me to the cop car. That night, after we were bailed out, Dean took us to the boat. "You guys were great," they told us. "You blocked that shipment for 5 hours. The boat never made it to the dock, so without you the whole action would have been a waste. There was lots of press. One of the TV stations sent a helicopter, and we saw you wave." 2 months later, the Great Lakes Water Quality Commission recommended a ban on chlorine production. A year later, I saw that cop again. He came to our trial wearing a Greenpeace button.
That was Under the Van, written and read by Beth Jones. Let's hear Jones read Zapatista's story next, here on Life Rattle.
Zapatista's story by Beth Jones. The Zapatistas invited us by email. At the next meeting of our solidarity group, Andrea read the message aloud. Our heroes were poor Indians living in the jungles of southern Mexico and fighting for justice and democracy against the one-party rule of the Mexican elite. Their leader, Marcos, was a poet who rode a horse, carried a rifle, and wrote treatises to his pet cockroach about the evils of free trade. The message was from him. The Zapatista National Liberation Army wishes to invite you to attend the first intercontinental gathering for humanity and against neoliberalism. It will take place in our camps, and we would be honored by the presence of all who are aligned with our struggle. Everyone wanted to go, but I was the only one that could get time off work. "I am so jealous," said Andrea, as she hugged me goodbye at the airport. "Just imagine, in a few days you'll be there. You'll be in the jungle with the Zapatistas. Late at night, you'll sit around with them, and you'll develop strategies together to fight global corporate rule. It'll be amazing." I promised to bring back a complete report. Then I tucked the envelope she handed me into my money belt, picked up my bag, and walked through airport security. 3 nights later, I lay awake on the dirt floor of a meeting hall in a Zapatista camp called Roberto Barrios. Over 2,000 admirers from around the world had accepted the Zapatistas' invitation, and about 100 of them are sleeping on that floor with me. Our bodies, backpacks, and hiking boots covered the floor, with narrow pathways dividing us into semi-orderly rows. At each doorway, a Zapatista stood guard. They wore red bandanas as masks and carried big sticks like soldiers carry rifles. The meeting hall was an open-air construction with waist-high woven grass walls. Overhead, a gentle rain fell on the thatched roof, then dripped off its edges into the foot-wide trench that surrounded the structure like a tiny moat. I lay flat on my back, eyes closed, arms at my sides. I tried to lull myself to sleep through the gentle murmur of late-night conversations. Around me, I could hear people talking in Italian, Spanish, and German. But my immediate neighbors were sound asleep, and I was cramped between them with only a few inches to spare. To fight off claustrophobia, I stretched my arms across the pathway above my head. After 10 minutes in this position, I was no closer to sleep, so I decided to get up and look for a conversation in English that I could join. I sat up. A small movement nearby caught my eye. A scorpion, its tail curled tightly upwards, scuttled along the pathway, headed for the space my outstretched arms had just vacated. I caught the eye of the nearest Zapatista guard. "Sir, there's a..." I said in Spanish. I couldn't remember the Spanish word for scorpion, but he saw where I was pointing. He walked over and jabbed at the scorpion with his stick. Injured, but not dead, it scurried under the edge of my neighbor's sleeping bag. The guard calmly picked up the edge of her sleeping bag, located the scorpion, and jabbed again. "There was a scorpion," I said in English to my neighbor, now awake and looking puzzled. She didn't answer, and I wasn't sure if she understood English, so I pointed at its shriveled remains. The Zapatista picked up the dead scorpion with his stick and walked back to the door. With a flick, he tossed it like a cigarette butt into the rainy night. Then he resumed his watchful stance. I turned back to my neighbor, with renewed hope for conversation, but she had already rolled over and gone back to sleep. I sighed and lay back down. I decided to try to tire myself out by thinking about the journey that had brought me from Toronto International Airport to this floor. I reviewed each step and counted the hours as if they were sheep. 5 hours on the plane to Mexico City. 9 hours on the overnight bus to the meeting point in San Cristobal. A 5-hour wait at the meeting point while 2,000 gringos were arranged into busloads, and then a 3-hour ride in a river of buses to the first camp at Oventique. Outside the gates, we waited for 2 hours while young Zapatista women wearing red bandana masks searched our packs for forbidden items like knives, guns, drugs, and alcohol. For me, that wait ended with 2 minutes of embarrassment when the 16-year-old girl who inspected my baggage discovered my optimistic stash of condoms. She looked up at me quizzically, as if to ask what they were. Her cheeks turned red above her mask when she saw my blush. Before I could figure out the Spanish word for condom, she had put them back. Once inside the gates of Oventique, we sat for 6 hours on makeshift bleachers watching the opening ceremonies, and then slept for 5 hours on last night's dirt floor. In the morning, they divided us into 5 groups to go to 5 different camps. I was one of 250 selected to go to Roberto Barrios. There was another hour waiting for another bus, and then 9 hours sitting on that bus as we made our way to Roberto Barrios. The bus ride itself had only been a 5.5-hour journey, but it had been interrupted by 1 hour waiting at a military checkpoint, 1 hour waiting to fix a flat tire, 1 hour waiting while a broken bridge was repaired, and then another 30 minutes waiting at another military checkpoint. Then, when we thought we had arrived, when they told us to get off the bus, we trekked for another 30 minutes, wading with our gear through a stream too deep for the bus to navigate. Outside the gates of Roberto Barrios, we waited for another hour while they searched our packs again, this time with less care, so I was spared a second round of condom-related embarrassment. After running through this 46.5-hour adventure a few more times, I did eventually fall asleep. I woke up the next morning, still flat on my back, refreshed and eager. The day I'd been anticipating for weeks had finally come. This afternoon we would divide into discussion groups. I'd finally get to sit down with the Zapatistas and develop strategies to fight global corporate rule. I got up from my bed. A tall, light-skinned woman wearing a red name tag gave me directions to the showers. On my way, I got my first look at Roberto Barrios in the daylight. It was a tiny compound, with a few dozen huts of various sizes connected by dirt pathways. I had to pick my way to the showers carefully, since last night's rain and the dirt pathway were getting stirred together under our 500 extra feet. By breakfast time, people were joking that Roberto Barrios should be renamed Roberto Barro, since Barro means mud in Spanish. The nickname stuck. For the next 4 days, we hobbled ankle-deep in mud that clung to our hiking boots and doubled their weight. We scraped the mud off with sticks, but one step outside the protection of the thatched roofs, and it would be there again. The Zapatistas seemed unperturbed. The mud washed easily off their rubber boots. While we ate breakfast in the dining hall, rows of chairs had been arranged on the floor of the meeting hall where we had slept the night before. For 3 hours, the comandantes of Roberto Barrios welcomed us to their camp and recounted some of the history of their struggle. I looked around the room. By lunchtime, I figured out there were four kinds of people at Roberto Barrios. The participants were a multinational array, mostly European and American, but some from Africa, South America, Australia, and Asia. We wore hiking boots and looked tired. The volunteers were tall, light-skinned Mexicans who dressed like professors and students from Mexico City. They wore red name tags and told us what to do. The Zapatistas that lived in Roberto Barrios were short, dark-skinned Mayans. They wore red bandana masks and watched us quietly. The comandantes were the Zapatista leaders in the community. They gave welcoming speeches and wore ski masks that revealed only their eyes and mouths. After lunch, the discussion groups finally got started. I had signed up for the discussion group called Dictatorship of the Free Market, Debt, and Poverty. There were about 50 of us in our discussion group. One of the volunteer organizers, a university professor from Mexico City, chaired the meeting. Beside him sat a ski mask-wearing comandante. The professor introduced her as Comandante Beatriz. I looked around and felt disappointed to see that she was the only Zapatista in the room. We spent 2 days in this discussion group. One by one, the participants stood up and gave ideological speeches in awkward Spanish. The Italian Marxists talked about struggles for a shorter work week. The Chilean feminists talked about campaigns to count women's work in the GDP. A Haitian development worker talked about campaigns to forgive third world debt. The French labor activists talked about their recent general strike. When my turn came, I got up and talked about our struggles to save Canada's social programs. Then an American anarchist got up and talked about Buy Nothing Day. As the hours wore on, my disappointment grew. I'd heard it all before, and I agreed with most of what people were saying, but sitting here in the jungle, none of it seemed very relevant. What could a shorter work week mean to a group of poor Indians who survived by growing corn and raising chickens? I wanted to hear what the Zapatistas thought about how these struggles linked with theirs. I kept looking at Comandante Beatriz, hoping she would ask a question or make a comment. But she never said anything. In fact, several times I thought I could see her yawn behind her ski mask. Comandante Beatriz wasn't the only one who remained silent. For the 4 days we were there, the Zapatistas watched us, stony-faced behind their masks, as we ate the food they cooked for us, slept in the huts they built for us, and stood in line at the showers they had specially constructed for us. Except for a few rousing speeches from the comandantes at the beginning and the end of each day, the Zapatistas didn't talk to us. The volunteers from Mexico City were the ones who patiently guided us through each day, who told us where to go and what to do. By the third day, I'd given up on any serious dialogue with the Zapatistas about strategy. I began worrying about another problem. The envelope that Andrea had given me at the airport. In it was the money that our solidarity group had raised to donate to the Zapatista cause. I had been entrusted to deliver it to them. I looked around for a donation booth, but didn't see any. It was now the day before we were scheduled to leave. I had to deal with it. On my way to the breakfast lineup, I stopped one of the volunteers. "I have a donation. What should I do?" I asked. "I'll find out," he replied, and walked away. I waited, but he didn't come back. Eventually, I just joined the breakfast lineup and resolved to try again at lunch. As I stood in the lunch lineup, I felt a tap on my shoulder. I turned to see a different volunteer smiling nervously at me. "Are you the one who wanted to make the donation?" he asked, looking at me, then away, then at me again. "Yes," I answered. "Then come with me," he said. He led me to a tent in the middle of an open space in the compound. Inside the tent, behind a table, sat an older volunteer. "Is this the one?" he asked my guide. "Yes, she's the one," he answered. Then the man behind the table turned to me. "You need to write a note. It should explain who you are and say that you want to make a donation," he said. "Oh," I said. I pulled out my notebook and turned to a blank page. With pen in hand, I thought back to my intermediate Spanish classes and tried to remember the right verb conjugations for the two sentences I needed to write. I scribbled something down, tore out the page, and handed it to him. His solemn expression did not change as he read it over. "All right, you can go and get your lunch now. Someone will find you." I turned to leave, then turned back. "It's only a small donation," I said. "It doesn't matter. The comandantes want to meet everyone who's making a donation." "Oh, okay," I said. An hour later, standing in line to wash my dishes, I felt another tap on my shoulder. "Are you the one with the donation?" asked yet another volunteer. "Yes," I said. "Where will you be at 5 o'clock? He asked. "I'll be in my discussion group. We meet in the back end of the meeting hall." "Okay. Someone will come and find you." I sat anxiously all afternoon, unable to pay attention to the discussion. 5 o'clock came and went. No one tapped on my shoulder. I looked around expectantly in the dinner lineup, and then in the dishwashing lineup, but still no one came. They must have forgotten about me, I thought. We were leaving the next morning, and I figured if no one approached me before we headed out of the camp, I would just have to walk up to one of the masked guards and hand the envelope over. That night, they held a big closing party for us. The Zapatistas danced local Indian dances for us. Then, groups from different countries started getting up. They performed skits, sang national songs, and danced national dances. The tap on the shoulder came during the American Hippies juggling act. The volunteer led me to the back of the meeting hall and handed me over to one of the masked Zapatista guards. "Wait," said the guard. 10 minutes passed. "Okay, now we go," he said. I looked around, but I couldn't see where the signal had come from. He led me along the muddy path that went to the showers and then turned right onto a path that was strangely mud-free. It led to a small shack I hadn't noticed before. The guard stopped in front of the shack and gestured towards the door. I opened it and went inside. A lone bulb hanging from the ceiling lit the room. 4 masked comandantes sat behind a table. I recognized one of them as Comandante Beatriz from our discussion group. There was 1 wooden chair in front of the table. "Hello," I said from the door. "Welcome," one of the men said, and gestured towards the chair. I walked to it and sat down. They looked at me expectantly. I looked at them. After about half a minute of silence, I decided they were waiting for me to speak, so I launched into a description of our solidarity group. We are a small group of young people who admire your struggle very much. We have collected signatures on your petitions and organized demonstrations in front of the Mexican embassy. The biggest thing we did was a caravan last year. 15 of us drove down from Toronto. We brought food, medical supplies, vehicles, and money to a number of communities in the area. We weren't able to organize much this year, only a few benefits. So we only have $265 to give you. My Spanish was so halting, I was sure it made me sound like a 7-year-old. I looked up at them and tried to figure out if they had understood my speech. They said nothing. A couple of them nodded. I pulled the envelope from my money belt and placed it on the table in front of me. "It isn't much, but we hope it will help," I said, pushing it across the table to them. Comandante Beatriz reached out and took the envelope. She didn't open it. "Thank you for the contribution," said the man who had first welcomed me. "The work that your group is doing is very important, and it helps us a great deal. This contribution that you offer us today will help us in our struggle here. We appreciate very much learning about your group. We have just one question for you." I shifted in my chair, turning to face him more directly. "A question? What could they possibly want to ask me?" Then my heart started to pound. Maybe this was my moment. Maybe this was when I was going to have my late-night conversation with the Zapatistas, developing strategies to fight global corporate rule. Then another thought occurred to me, and a pit formed in the bottom of my stomach. What if they already heard about the caravan we organized last year? After we got back to Toronto, we heard rumors of a controversy. One of the communities we had visited was now out of favor with the Zapatistas. There had been a dispute, but we could never figure out the details. There was no way I'd be able to explain the circumstances in my 7-year-old Spanish. "A question?" I said. "Yes. We would like to know if you would like a receipt." "A receipt?" I said. "Why would I want a receipt? At the next checkpoint we crossed, the Mexican police would know just by looking at me. They would search my bags and find it, and then they would banish me forever. Maybe worse. Maybe they would find some excuse to detain me." "Oh, no, I don't need a receipt. The group trusts me. No, it's okay. I don't need a receipt." "All right, then. Thank you very much," he said. I stood up and backed away. Then I opened the door and stepped back out into the night. "Wow," I thought. "I can't wait to tell Andrea about that." Across the dark compound, I could see the lights of the meeting hall. I could hear the sounds of laughter and singing as the party continued. My bandana-masked companion stood waiting for me, and he walked me back towards the party. As I took my seat again, the French were just finishing off a rousing rendition of the Internationale. I picked up a stick to scrape away the inch-thick coating of muck that my boots had accumulated on the trip across the compound. Imagine offering me a receipt. That's so weird, I thought. Then it hit me. I was crazy to say no. I thought about running back over to the hut, but it was too late. If only I had said yes, I would have had a hand-signed receipt from the Zapatistas. I could have gone to the next Solidarity Group meeting with a receipt from our heroes for the money that we had raised. It would have been the most treasured possession the group would ever have. The next morning, we left Roberto Barrios and started the lengthy bus journey back out of the jungle. We passed through many military checkpoints. No one ever searched my bags.
That was Zapatista Story, written and read by Beth Jones. And that concludes Life Rattle number 1298. Arnie Ackman recorded Beth Jones reading her story. My name is Virginia Ashbery. Life Rattle is produced from Toronto and was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. And tune in again soon for more great Life Rattle stories.